Compliance Clarified, a podcast by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence.
Hello and welcome to Compliance Clarified, a podcast for risk and compliance professionals brought to you by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence. Each week, we discuss news stories and topical issues from our journalists and analysts in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. I'm Rachel Wolcott, Senior Editor in London, and today I'm speaking to special guest Justine Walker, Global Head of Sanctions and Risk for the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists, known more widely as ACAMS. Welcome, Justine.
Rachel, great to be here. Thanks so much for the invite.
A pleasure. Justine brings a wealth of experience to the sanctions topic, and we're delighted to have her on the podcast. She's an expert on sanctions, counterterrorism, and financial crime. She's held specialist positions at the UK Financial Conduct Authority, HM Treasury, as well as the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and UK Finance. Today, we're going to talk about the increasing complexity in the sanctions landscape. We're seeing all kinds of new sanctions issued by the United States, the UK, and the European Union in response to a variety of threats, including Russia, Iran, organized crime, human rights abuses, as well as a cyber threat and terrorist financing from Hamas. There's a lot for financial services firms and anyone doing business with high-risk corporate entities to understand. Justine, we just marked the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Despite what we're told were unprecedented sanctions against Russia, the country seems to be able to get everything it needs to keep the war going. In particular, we see reports about products derived from Russian oil imported into the UK, as well as other practices that exploit sanctions loopholes. Where are we now with Russia sanctions?
Well, I mean, this is the question everybody is asking, particularly given we're at this 2-year anniversary. And I think it's really important, and I keep stressing this to people, that everybody understands Russia had spent many years analysing Western sanctions and looking at how they could best tailor their microeconomic response to blunt the impact of potentially what would be down the road if they invaded Ukraine. So they clearly gave this a lot of consideration. And, you know, to some extent, they've been successful. And because they were so prepared, it has had an impact on where we are today regarding implementation. But it's equally important to really keep in mind, for Russia to continue being resilient, it really needs to be able to think about how it will continue to protect itself from sanctions. And, you know, one of the key standout elements has clearly been the whole US G7 alliance. You know, everybody's spoken about this. This is going to be nothing new. This continues. You know, the big focus around the oil, you know, the oil sort of side of things, you mentioned that, and the price cap, really novel measure. But I think it's also really important to stress it wasn't intended to stop Russian oil flows, but it was to limit the amount of money that Russia could raise from oil sales. And yes, of course, there's prohibitions as well, depending on what country you're looking at. So we've seen a lot in this space. We've seen a lot of discussion around Russia was able to continue selling oil above the $60 price cap. We've also seen, you know, allies talking about toughening up sanctions and limiting sanction circumvention. But what I would say is, you know, to date, we've seen quite limited enforcement action, but I think we're entering into a much more aggressive phase regarding the price cap. We've got new price cap assertion requirements. We've had a flurry of new guidance. So in terms of where we're at and effectiveness, it really does depend who you speak to. You know, Russia is having to transport its oil over longer distances. They're more reliant on shadow fleets, which tend to be older tankers. And this is just definitely not desirable for a major oil exporting economy. We've also seen a lot of change in market dynamics with, you know, exodus of Greek tank owners. But, you know, they're still raising money from oil revenue. So that is clearly the case. And with that, I do think we're probably going to see this play out in terms of more enforcement. And I think this year is going to be pretty informative in terms of how the oil price cap will end up being in terms of a longer term tool. The other really important measure to really stress around where we're at is the implementation of Executive Order 14114, which President Biden signed into force in December. This has really taken what was a very tiptoeing, light sort of touch element around secondary sanctions into being a much more of a real dilemma for banks globally, non-US banks, that is, in terms of whether that's China, whether it's Turkey, UAE, Central Asia. And this is certainly having an impact with people revisiting their exposure. So in terms of being 2 years on, people are still very much looking at sanctions. They're still looking at how they may be exposed. The other really important element around the executive order was the change in knowledge standard. And that's been a key aspect, which, you know, again, we will see how that is interpreted this year. And then I think, you know, more broadly, and just to sort of summarize on where we may be at and what we may see in 2024, but I do think we're going to see a bit more focus around nuclear energy, maybe lowering the price cap. That might come onto as a more alive discussion. Let's see. We're going to definitely look at continued focus around circumvention and evasion. That's top priority, secondary sanctions. And this wider nexus around enhanced enforcement and due diligence beyond know your customer, you know, this whole AML sanctions nexus and the export control. And finally, what I would say is probably greater spillover across wider sanctions regimes. So not just it being broadly under the Russia-Ukraine sort of framework. So that's where I think we are at the moment.
Yeah, and it seems like the US continues to lead the way, especially on imposing new sanctions and as well as continuing its strength in on the enforcement side. And that's something that firms should really keep in mind, that the U.S. fines, when they come, tend to be pretty substantial, pretty meaty. The U.S. Treasury, continuing on that theme, has imposed more sanctions on Iran this year in response to what's been going on in the Middle East, particularly in the Red Sea. So it sanctioned the deputy commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, who they're saying is a Houthi-affiliated operator who has supported the Houthis' actions in the Red Sea. So what should firms be aware of in terms of wider developments? So you already touched on some, but it, particularly in relation to Iran and the escalating Israeli-Gaza conflict.
Yeah, so, I mean, throughout 2023, OFAC took a fairly aggressive stance around issuing sanctions designating Iranian-linked parties. And that was for a whole array of activity. And I think it's worthwhile keeping that in mind. So some of the instances were around Iran's support for Russia's involvement in the war in Ukraine and their activities there. So we saw sanctions on developing and exporting unmanned aerial vehicles. That was one strand we saw. A big focus around whether Russia is really managing to gain battlefield goods and technology from Iran. We also saw Iran being subject to sanctions in respect to their own ballistic missiles procurement. And, you know, one element of that was in October, pertinent to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 and the ban on Iran's import and export of missiles and drone-related technology. That expired, so that sort of brought that more to a fore. The whole petroleum side of things, you know, interesting to note that, you know, the value and quantity of Iran's exports rose in 2023 to the highest levels in the past 5 years. again, probably not surprising, you know, China by far the biggest purchaser of Iranian oil. So we've seen sort of a range of dynamics there, but we've also seen wrongful sanctions around wrongful detention of US nationals, and also sanctions in respect to protests and restrictions on internet access. So a whole breadth there. But, you know, the other element in 2023 was just the wider US-Iran tension. So we did see in the early part, and taking place last year, some US and Iran engaging in direct talks over a possible return to the JCPOA. And we did see a completed a prisoner swap. So, you know, it wasn't all negative. But gosh, that certainly took a turn for a more challenging environment given Hamas's October the 7th attacks and the subsequent regional conflict. So we're now in a real spiked environment of tensions, and we've seen more sanctions coming out, you know, around parties, you know, and potentially we could see more sanctions in the secondary sanctions space on, you know, individuals engaging in significant transactions involving Iran, potentially escalation there. You know, we're not going to really receive a return to the JCPOA under the current environment. So most people are thinking it is, you know, the normal sanctions, high risk scenario for Iran. But I mean, clearly you mentioned what's happening in the Red Sea and the Houthis. That has brought things even more to the forefront. And the airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen, also airstrikes on Iranian-linked targets in Iraq and Syria in early February 2024. And, you know, so all of these things are creating a much more complex regional environment, which industry is going to need to navigate. So you've not just got the Iranian aspect, but you've got the Iranian-Russia nexus, you've got the Iranian-Houthi nexus, and then of course you've got the dynamics within the Gaza Strip at the moment in terms of what is happening there, and also the, you know, humanitarian situation, which is clearly front page news across the world, and there's going to be a real need for industry to navigate that aspect when the situation starts to move into a rebuilding, reconstruction environment, which, you know, one would assume, you know, eventually that will be the situation, and presumably at some point in 2024 we'll move into those type of discussions. So,
well, hopefully.
Well, we all hope that. So a lot of shifting elements here, a lot of geopolitics, a lot of complexity around the sanctions landscape, and people are going to have to really follow this in depth and really kind of like be much more sophisticated in their risk assessments, be much more attuned to the dynamics of risk assessment. So, for example, the sanctions targeting the Houthis, you know, it's not a complete ban on doing business in Yemen. It's not targeting the Yemeni population. It is very much targeting the military suppression activities of the Houthis. So again, people need to think about that, given Yemen is one of the, you know, biggest humanitarian needs situations in the world. So, you know, that humanitarian permissible payments nexus should be much more at people's forefront during 2024.
Yeah, it's just to go back to what you were saying about Russia having studied the impact of sanctions before it went fully into, or has attempted fully to go into Ukraine. Do you think that's something that's also happening with Iran when it's making its calculations? It seems that one of the things that's come up over the last 2 years is, like you say, these kind of networks between Russia, you mentioned Iran, also North Korea. You mentioned that Iran is making a lot more money from the Chinese. Like, it seems like some kind of further analysis has gone on here, and I was just wondering if you were seeing this as a coordinated approach or if it was more ad hoc.
So I don't see it as a coordinated approach in that way, and I think, you know, it's very important to distinguish between the situation that Iran is in with long-term sanctions, being disconnected from the international financial system for many, many years, compared to Russia, which is a major global economy, you know, what, number 11th in the world before this happened, a superpower sitting as part of, you know, the UN Security Council. So in my mind, the two are not comparable in terms of Russia was, you know, they have a very developed regulatory framework. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Russia, working in Russia. And, you know, it's a very sophisticated central bank, it's a very sophisticated way of functioning. So they were able to put in place macroeconomic measures to try and, you know, dilute the impact of what they assumed might be international sanctions. However, I think it's pretty clear for everybody to see the protracted nature of this war was not expected. You know, Russia expected this to be over much quicker. The international community didn't expect that they would have to go to the levels that they've had to go to. I mean, just before the invasion, the full-scale invasion, you know, we were just talking about, would it be disconnection of, you know, a couple of the big, you know, maybe the sixth, seventh, eighth largest bank in Russia, you know, that nobody thought it would be, you know, all the SWIFT measures we've seen. Nobody thought it would be all the oil measures. So this has surpassed anything that anybody had expected. So no, I don't think it's been some very clever coordinated aspect. But circumstances are circumstances and geopolitics are geopolitics. So people respond. So of course, you know, the Russia-North Korea discussions, you know, I'm sure that wasn't high up on Russia's planning 2 years ago, but out of necessity, they've had to look at that. You know, and I think that's probably been a difficult one for them, given, you know, they've been party to the North Korea sanctions, the UN sanctions for many years as well. So, you know, I think it's just how this has evolved is what I would say.
You noted a growing nexus between sanctions, AML, and also export controls. It seems like governments, particularly the U.S., are concerned about certain technology. You've touched on that before with drones and other battlefield technology getting to the hands of the Russians and Iranians, just as one example. Can you unpack what that means for listeners and explain what this means for the compliance world?
Well, I think it means some sleepless nights for the compliance world, to be honest. You know, this is one of the big challenges, is this merger, I suppose, between export control requirements, AML, and sanctions. I mean, there's been more of a nexus between AML and sanctions, but the nexus with export controls has not been there to what we're now seeing is being asked. So we're seeing much greater expectations from governments that financial institutions will become more proactive in their thinking around their role in sensitive technology, strategic trade, export control. And that is a whole area of speciality in itself. It's so complex. I mean, we did a couple of battlefield goods infographics, and oh my goodness, the complexity in looking at that was incredible. And the reason we did that was to try and help people understand, well, what actually is a battlefield good? What's a sensitive technology? This is going to be really the forefront of where we're going to see activities in 2024. On that lens of looking at, you know, what are the real goods that the Western community do not want Russia to have access to, and trying to communicate that with financial institutions. And then financial institutions, and indeed others, anybody who exports, but let's say we're talking primarily here about financial institutions, really then thinking about how do they respond to that? How do they utilize their AML tools? How do they prioritize what they're looking for? I mean, we've just issued a toolkit on this around Russian sanctions evasion and how to focus your thinking. And we had to have a lot of discussions because, A, the pace of change has been so dramatic. You know, there's so many new circulars coming out, so many new alliances. You know, there's different lists, you know, put out, whether in Australia or Canada or the UK, the US. And we've seen some alignments there, but there's also quite a lot of difference around expectations. So for financial institutions, this is definitely one in that sanctions realm where senior executives are having to think about how do they bring these different functions together? What is practical? Where should they prioritize? But, you know, when you're prioritizing, you still can't forget about all the nuts and bolts and all the other sanctions regimes which are happening. So it's not as if you can just turn off the tap on Iran or North Korea. You have to do this on top of everything else. So that is presenting real challenges for financial institutions. But definitely 2024 is going to be the year around export controls, sanctions evasion, battlefield goods. People should really be focused on what are their obligations, what is evasion, you know, how should they be tuning their internal controls and what should they focus on?
Yeah, obviously the battlefield goods and technology are going to be huge because the more of that Russia can get, the longer it can keep the war in Ukraine going. This will be something that the US in particular is going to be really laser focused on.
And I would say not just the US, you know, this is, yes, we're seeing a lot come out from the US, but we're also seeing a lot come out from a number of other jurisdictions as well. So I would say this is a G7 type of environment. I just think you probably have bigger agencies in the US in terms of BIS and their role, you know, that whole export control arena. But it would be a mistake to think this is just the US. It is a G7 initiative. And that is very clear what we're seeing in our global discussions with members.
Well, that is something that people need to keep in mind. Don't only worry about what the US enforcement and regulatory agencies are doing.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.
But to shift gears completely away from Russia, this is something I really wanted to ask you about, because ACAMS has really been at the forefront of highlighting the scourge that is pig butchering. I think that some of your analysts were amongst the first to start raising pig butchering as a big problem. So that's just to let anybody know who doesn't know what pig butchering is, it's a kind of cryptocurrency related scam, sometimes like a romance scam, where you get a call or you get contacted on social media. People want to be your friends. They convince you to invest in cryptocurrency investments, but really what you're doing is just putting money directly into the scammer's wallet. And it's now become, according to Bloomberg, a $75 billion scam, a global problem in terms of people losing their life savings. And locally in the Mekong region and elsewhere now, people are trafficked there to run the scams. So pig butchering seems to be at the core of some pretty terrible crimes and human rights abuses. The US, the EU, and others have responded with sanctions on individuals related to human rights and organized crime. Can you talk a little bit about how the risks from cyber-enabled crime may impact the future sanctions landscape?
Yeah, so, I mean, thank you for the acknowledgement around pig butchering. One of the great opportunities within ACAMS, and it's a real privilege to be able to use your global footprint and connect different parts of our community. And what we were hearing from some parts of our community was about pig butchering, and we were saying, but we're not seeing much out there. So we really amplified the voice of others, where we did, you know, a joined ACAMS Homeland Security investigations. We did a joint alert with them, and we did a load of infographics. We did a load of other work on this. And as you said, and it's just great, and let me just focus on pig butchering, because it is a great example of just the challenges around these crimes and what does it mean for that wider sort of cyborg-enabled criminal activity. I mean, pig butchering is absolutely horrendous. You know, it's got elements of human trafficking, as you've said, fabricated websites, targeted social engineering, ties across a range of organized crime groups. So clearly financial institutions have to be aware of this. But what they also need to understand is it's not just a activity which happens elsewhere. So one of the things we tried to do in ACAMS was put out material which shone a spotlight on the global nexus around pig butchering. So if you're in the US, what does that look like for financial institutions? But if you're in Asia, what does that look like? Because, you know, you mentioned the human trafficking element and, you know, the whole thing, the basis around this is that, you know, there'll be fake job adverts attracting young people, often from China, but also other countries. They're then held against their, you know, their will in these industrial scale scam centers. That does give a financial footprint. So how do you look at that? So the big things for, you know, the wider financial crime community is A, to understand the typology, but then how to understand how does that impact me? So that's what we've been doing on pig butchering, but the whole cyber-enabled fraud space is absolutely one of the largest and fastest growing generators of illicit proceeds. When our global threats reporter came out as the number three top threat in our report, just because of the scale of it and just, you know, the complexity of it. But what I would also say is it's not just cyber-enabled fraud, it's the environment it's sitting within. So I would say cyber-enabled fraud plus the offensive use of technology by criminals, if you sort of put them together, that creates a pretty scary future in terms of, for compliance officers, of how do you navigate the hostile use of technology, whether that be commercial spyware, ransomware, offensive cyber capabilities. And, you know, again, you know, talking about the Global Threat Report, that absolutely was up there in senior executives' concerns. You know, this was one of the things that really keeping people awake at night. So what does this all mean for the compliance officer? Well, one thing, it really means that people need to understand how does the risks of cyber-enabled fraud and offensive use of technology by criminals, how does that present itself? What does it mean for, you know, deepfakes, these type of things? But what does it mean for, you know, putting this, mapping this against traditional typology frameworks? How can you sort of identify red flags? How can you become more sophisticated with that? And it is going to create quite a bit of a sea change in attitude and understanding and responses to really be able to manage this typology. And what I would also say, it's changing month on month on what does this look like. You know, the whole deepfake environment. And, you know, we saw the very well reported case of somebody being, you know, conned by a deepfake video conference with what the individual thought was, you know, a board meeting, and they then transferred millions of dollars on the back of that. So this is going to be a real challenge. And I don't think anybody has the answers, but it's certainly going to be something which everybody's going to be very focused on for the foreseeable years ahead.
Yeah. Definitely. It's like we were saying at the beginning, the kind of threat landscape is getting more and more complex. And on that note, I mean, you've covered a lot of different and sticky problems facing compliance and senior leaders at financial services firms. I realize it's difficult to summarize in terms of takeaways, but what would your advice to compliance officers being faced with telling this really difficult story to their senior leadership?
So I think it's being, I mean, if you're saying, you know, what do you tell your senior leadership? I think the most important thing is to tell your senior leadership the truth around how the environment is changing. You know, what does this mean for the compliance function? What are the risks from technology, but also what are the opportunities from technology? You know, are there things we're doing today we could do in a different way tomorrow if we, you know, calibrated our systems differently? I think also the thing I would push up to senior leadership is the need for really open conversations with regulators and at the international standards, so Financial Action Task Force and others, around what does the future effectiveness of the financial crime framework looks like. I mean, one of the things we really prioritized this year in our work stream is a whole program on incentivizing effectiveness, because what does that really mean? You know, we can't keep adding and adding on every single new provision, new typology. We have to prioritize them and look at where is the serious harm, what's really important, how can financial institutions, if they're investing in, you know, forward-leaning thinking around technology, you know, how do they get some credit for that? What are the sandbox opportunities there? The other thing I think is really important, and, you know, I've mentioned it a couple of times, is the Global Threat Report. And, you know, I hope that's okay to keep mentioning it. But, you know, we're pretty proud of this report because, you know, we surveyed a lot of people and we spoke at a very senior level across the globe to people in person, whether that was in China. And these were in-person roundtables in China, the UAE, Europe, the US. And what I would say is, you know, take that report, summarize it for your senior leadership to say, look, this is what is being seen as the top 10 threats. Does this match our view of the world? And, you know, there may be some differences there, which is completely right, but I think there'll be a lot of synergies then to say, well, what are we actually doing about this? The other thing I would say, and this is one of the really interesting things which came out of the report, which is some of the regional variations. So we did see some issues sitting much higher in Oceania, for example, to the Middle East, to the US. And, you know, I think it's good for people to look at how do they sit, you know, is that, do they think that's the right position for them? Should they be more focused on some of these threats coming down the line for 2024? So, you know, good management upwards information is critical to your boards, to your senior leadership. And I hope this has kind of helped a bit to, you know, that report helped a bit to sort of give that upwards information. So that's the key takeaway I would say, is make sure whatever you're putting upwards to your leadership is focused, is informative, and that they can look at not just the threat for today, but what is the threat in 6, 12, 24 months' time, so they can ensure readiness. And that's a key thing the regulators are looking at, is how are financial institutions becoming more ready for the threats of today, but also the threats of the future.
Excellent. That is great advice. And we can put a link to the threat report in the show notes. And that is it for this week's Compliance Clarified. Thank you very much, Justine. Your feedback is important to us, so please give us a rating on your podcast platform of choice, or you can get in touch directly. Our contact details are in the show notes. For more information about regulatory intelligence, please search for Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence on the internet or check the show notes for a link. Thanks again, and goodbye.
Compliance Clarified, a podcast by Thomson Reuters Regulatory Intelligence.